walking in their direction. "Here they are," she said. "We eat just before dark, then we go to sleep."
"I guess there's nothing to do afterward."
"Nothing we can discuss," she said quickly, and it was funny.
Jevy appeared with a group of Indians, one of whom handed Rachel a small square basket. She passed it to Nate, who removed a small loaf of hard bread.
"This is manioc," she said. "It's our main food."
And evidently their only food, at least for that meal. Nate was into his second loaf when they were joined by Indians from the first village. They brought the tent, mosquito net, blankets, and bottled water from the boat.
"We're staying here tonight," Nate said to Jevy.
"Says who?"
"It's the best spot," Rachel said. "I would offer you a place in the village, but the leader must first approve a visit by white men."
"That would be me," Nate said.
"Yes."
"And not him?" He nodded at Jevy.
"He went for food, not to sleep. The rules are complicated."
This struck Nate as funny. Primitive natives yet to discover clothing, but following a complicated system of rules.
"I would like to leave by noon tomorrow," Nate said to her.
"That, too, will be up to the leader."
"You mean we can't leave when we want?"
"You will leave when he says you can leave. Don't worry."
"Are you and the chief close?"
"We get along."
She sent the Indians back to the village. The sun had disappeared over the mountains. The shadows from the forest were engulfing them. For a few minutes, Rachel watched as Jevy and Nate struggled with the tent. It looked quite small, rolled up in its case, and expanded just a little as they hooked the poles together. Nate wasn't sure it would hold Jevy, let alone the both of them. Fully erected, it was waist-high, pitched sharply from the sides, and painfully small for two grown men.
"I'm going," she announced. "You will be fine here."
"Promise?" Nate said, with sincerity.
"I can have a couple of boys stand watch if you like."
"We'll be fine," Jevy said. "What time do you folks wake up around here?" Nate asked.
"An hour before sunrise."
"I'm sure we'll be awake," Nate said, glancing at the tent. "Can we meet early? We have a lot to discuss."
"Yes. I'll send some food out at daybreak, then we'll chat."
"That would be nice."
"Say your prayers, Mr. O'Reilly."
"I will." She stepped into the darkness and was gone. For a moment, Nate could see her silhouette winding along the trail, then nothing. The village was lost in the blackness of the night. They sat on the bench for hours, waiting for the air to cool, dreading the moment when they would be forced to pack themselves into the tent and sleep back to back, both smelly and sweaty. There was no choice. The tent, flimsy as it was, would protect them from mosquitoes and other insects. It would also keep out things that crawled. They talked about the village. Jevy told Indian stories, all of which ended in the death of someone. He finally asked,
"Did you tell her about the money?"
"No, I'll do that tomorrow."
"You've seen her now? What will she think about the money?"
"I have no idea. She's happy here. It seems cruel to upset her life."
"Then give me the money. It won't upset my life."
They followed the pecking order. Nate crawled into the tent first. He'd spent the previous night watching the sky from the bottom of the boat, so the fatigue hit fast. When he was snoring, Jevy slowly unzipped the tent door and nudged here and there until he had a spot. His pal was unconscious. Chapter 28 After 9 hours of sleep, the Ipecas arose before dawn to begin their day. The women built small cooking fires outside their huts, then left with the children for the river to collect water and to bathe. As a rule, they waited until first light to walk the dirt trails. It was prudent to see what lay before them. In Portuguese, the snake was known as an urutu. The Indians called it a bima. It was common around the waterways of southern Brazil and often fatal. The girl's name was Ayesh, age 7, helped into the world by the white missionary. Ayesh was walking in front of her mother instead of behind, as was the custom, and she felt the bima squirm under her bare foot. It struck her below the ankle as she screamed. By the time her father got to her, she was in shock, and her right foot had doubled in size. A boy of 15, the fastest runner in the tribe, was dispatched to get Rachel. There were 4 small Ipica settlements along 2 rivers that met in a fork very near the spot where Jevy and Nate had stopped. The distance from the fork to the last Ipica hut was no more than 5 miles. The settlements were distinct and self-contained little tribes, but they were all Ipicas, with the same language, heritage, and customs. They socialized and intermarried. Ayesh lived in the 3rd settlement from the fork. Rachel was in the 2nd, the largest. The runner found her as she was reading scriptures in the small hut where she'd lived for 11 years. She quickly checked her supplies and filled her small medical bag. There were 4 poisonous snakes in their part of the Pantanal, and at various times Rachel had had the antivenin for each. But not this time. The runner told her the snake was a bima. Its antivenin was manufactured by a Brazilian company, but she had been unable to find it during her last trip to Corumbá. The pharmacies there had less than half the medicine she needed. She laced her leather boots and left with her bag. Laco and 2 other boys from her village joined her as she jogged away through the tall weeds and into the woods. According to Rachel's statistics, there were 86 adult females, 81 adult males, and 72 children in the 4 settlements, a total of 239 Ipicas. When she began working with the Ipicas 11 years earlier, there had been 280. Malaria took the weak ones every few years. An outbreak of cholera killed 20 in 1 village in 1991. If Rachel hadn't insisted on a quarantine, most of the Ipicas would have been wiped out. With the diligence of an anthropologist, she kept records of births, deaths, weddings, family trees, illnesses, and treatments. Most of the time, she knew who was having an extramarital affair and with whom. She knew every name in every village. She had baptized Ayesh's parents in the river where they bathed. Ayesh was small and thin, and she would probably die, because there was no medicine. The antivenin was readily available in the States and in the larger cities of Brazil, and not terribly expensive. Her small budget from world tribes would cover it. 3 injections in 6 hours, and death could be prevented. Without it, the child would become violently ill with nausea, then a fever would hit, followed by a coma, then death. It had been 3 years since the Ipicas had seen a death by snake bite. And for the first time in 2 years, Rachel had no antivenin. Ayesha's parents were Christians, new saints, struggling with a new religion. About a third of the Ipicas had been converted. Because of the work of Rachel and her predecessors, half of them could read and write. She prayed as she trotted behind the boys. She was lean and tough. She walked several miles a day and ate little. The Indians admired her stamina. Jevy was washing himself in the river when Nate unzipped the mosquito fly and extricated himself from the tent. He still carried bruises from the plane crash. Sleeping in the boat and on the ground did little to ease the soreness. He stretched his back and legs, aching all over, feeling every one of his 48 years. He could see Jevy waist-deep in water that looked much clearer than the rest of the Pantanal. "I'm lost," Nate whispered to himself. "I'm hungry. I have no toilet paper." He gingerly touched his toes as he summed up his sad inventory. It was an adventure, damn it. It was time for all lawyers to charge into the new year with resolutions to bill more hours, win bigger verdicts, cut more overhead, take home more money. He'd made those vows for years, and now they seemed silly. With a little luck, he'd sleep in his hammock tonight, swinging in the breeze, sipping coffee. To the best of his recollection, Nate had never before longed for black beans and rice. Chevy returned as a patrol of Indians arrived from the village. The chief wanted to see them. "He wants to have bread," Chevy said as they walked away. "Bread's fine. Ask if they have bacon and eggs."
"They eat a lot of monkey."
He didn't appear to be kidding. At the edge of the village, a group of children stood, waiting for a look at the strangers. Nate offered them all a frozen smile. He'd never felt so white in his life, and he wanted to be liked. Some naked mothers gawked from the first hut. When he and Chevy entered the wide common area, everyone stopped and stared. Small fires were burning out. Breakfast was over. The smoke hung like fog over the roofs and made the humid air even stickier. It was a few minutes after 7 and already very hot. The village architect had done a fine job. Each dwelling was perfectly square with a thatched roof angled steeply almost to the ground. Some were larger than others, but the design never varied. They circled the settlement in an oval-shaped ring, all facing a large flat area, the town square. In the center were 4 large structures, 2 circular and 2 rectangular, and all had the same thick straw roofs. The chief was waiting for them. Not surprisingly, his home was the largest hut in the village, and he was the largest Indian of the lot. He was young and lacked the heavy wrinkles across the forehead and the thick belly the older men carried with pride. He stood and gave Nate a look that would have horrified John Wayne. An older warrior did the interpreting, and within minutes Nate and Chevy were asked to sit near the fire, where the chief's naked wife was preparing breakfast. When she bent over, her breast swung about, and poor Nate couldn't help but stare, if only for a long second. There was nothing particularly sexy about the naked woman or her breasts. It was just the fact that she could be so naked and so unconcerned about it. Where was his camera? The boys around the office would never believe it without proof. She handed Nate a wooden plate covered with a serving of what appeared to be boiled potatoes. He glanced at Chevy, who gave a quick nod as if he knew everything about Indian cuisine. She served the chief last, and when he began eating with his fingers, so did Nate. It was a cross between a turnip and a redskin potato, with very little taste. Chevy talked while he ate, and the chief enjoyed the conversation. After a few sentences, Chevy would translate things into English and pass them along. The village never flooded. They had been there for more than 10 years. The soil was good. They preferred not to move, but sometimes the soil forced them to. His father had been a chief, too. The chief, according to the chief, was the wisest, smartest, and fairest of them all, and he could not engage in extramarital affairs. Most of the other men did, but not the chief. Nate suspected there was little else to do but fool around. The chief had never seen the Paraguay River. He preferred hunting over fishing, thus spent more time in the woods than on the rivers. He'd learned basic Portuguese from his father and from the white missionaries. Nate ate, listened, and watched the village for any sign of Rachel. "She wasn't there," the chief explained. "She was in the next village, tending to a child who'd been bitten by a snake. He wasn't sure when she would return." "Just wonderful," thought Nate. "He wants us to stay here tonight in the village," Chevy said. The wife was refilling their plates. "Didn't know we were staying," Nate said. "He says we are. Tell him I'll think about it." "You tell him." Nate cursed himself for not bringing the sat phone. Josh was surely pacing the floor of his office right now, worried sick. They had not talked in 5 days. Chevy said something slightly humorous that upon translation became downright funny. The chief roared with laughter, and soon everyone else was laughing too, including Nate, who laughed at himself for laughing with the Indians. They declined an invitation to go hunting. A patrol of young men led them back to the first village to their boat. Chevy wanted to clean the spark plugs again and fiddle with the carburetor. Nate had nothing else to do.
Lawyer Valdir took the early call from Mr. Stafford. The pleasantries took only seconds.
"I haven't heard from Nate O'Reilly in 5 days," Stafford said.
"But he has one of those phones," Valdir said, on the defensive, as if it was his duty to protect Mr. O'Reilly.
"Yes, he does. That's what worries me. He can call any time from anywhere."
"Can he use the phone in bad weather?"
"No, I suppose not."
"We have had many storms down here. It is, after all, the rainy season."
"You haven't heard from your boy?"
"No, they're together. The guide is very good. The boat is very good. I'm sure they are well."
"Then why hasn't he called?"
"I can't answer. But the skies have not been clear. Perhaps he cannot use his phone."
They agreed to call at once if something was heard from the boat. Valdir walked to his open window and looked at the busy streets of Corumbá. The Paraguay River was just down the hill. Stories were legion of people who entered the Pantanal and never came back. It was part of the lore and the lure. Javi's father had piloted the rivers for 30 years, and his body was never recovered.
Welly found the law office an hour later. He had not met Mr. Valdir, but he knew from Javi that the lawyer was paying for the expedition.
"It's very important," he told the secretary. "It is urgent."
Valdir heard the ruckus and appeared from his office.
"Who are you?" he demanded.
"My name is Welly. Javi hired me as a deckhand on the Santa Laura."
"The Santa Laura?"
"Yes. Where is Javi?"
"He's still in the Pantanal."
"Where is the boat?"
"It sank."
Valdir realized the boy was tired and frightened.
"Sit down," he said,
and the secretary ran to get water.
"Tell me everything."
Welly clutched the arms of his chair and spoke rapidly.
"They left in the John boat to find the Indians, Javi and Mr. O'Reilly."
"When?"
"I don't know. A few days ago. I was to stay with the Santa Laura. A storm hit, the biggest storm ever. It blew the boat free in the middle of the night, then rolled it over. I was thrown into the water and picked up later by a cattle boat."
"When did you arrive here?"
"Only a half hour ago."
The secretary brought a glass of water. Welly thanked her and asked for coffee. Valdir leaned on her desk and watched the poor kid. He was dirty and smelled like cow manure.
"So the boat is gone?"
Valdir said.
"Yes. I'm sorry. There was nothing I could do. I've never seen such a storm."
"Where was Javi during the storm?"
"Somewhere on the Cabixá River. I fear for him."
Valdir walked to his office, where he closed the door and returned to his window. Mr. Stafford was 3,000 miles away. Javi could survive in a small boat. No sense jumping to conclusions. He decided not to call for a few days. Give Javi time, and surely he would return to Corumbá. The Indian stood in the boat and braced himself by clutching Nate's shoulder. There was no noticeable improvement in the motor's performance. It continued to sputter and miss, and at full throttle had less than half the power it had when they left the Santa Laura. They passed the first settlement, and the river bent and looped almost to the point of going in circles. Then it forked, and the Indian pointed. 20 minutes later, their little tent came into view. They docked where Javi had bathed earlier in the day. They broke camp and moved their belongings into the village where the chief wanted them. Rachel had not returned. Because she was not one of them, her hut was not in the oval. It was 100 feet away, nearer to the edge of the forest, alone. It appeared to be smaller than any of the others, and when Javi inquired about this, the Indian who had been assigned to them explained that it was because she had no family. The three of them, Nate, Javi, and their Indian, spent 2 hours under a tree at the edge of the village, watching the daily routine while waiting for Rachel.
The Indian had learned Portuguese from the Coopers, the missionary couple who had come before Rachel, and he had a few words of English he intermittently tried on Nate. The Coopers had been the first white people any of the Ipecas had ever seen. Mrs. Cooper died of malaria, and Mr. Cooper went back to wherever he came from. The men were hunting and fishing, he explained to his guests, and the younger ones were no doubt sneaking around seeing their girlfriends. The women had the hard work, cooking, baking, cleaning, watching the children, but labor was at a languid pace. If time moved slower south of the equator, then there was no clock at all among the Ipecas. The doors to the huts remained open, and children ran from one to the other. Young girls braided their hair in the shade while their mothers worked over the fires. Cleanliness was an obsession. The dirt of the common areas was swept with straw brooms. The exteriors of the huts were tidy and neat. The women and children bathed 3 times a day in the river, 2x for the men and never with the women. Everybody was naked, but some things were private. Late in the afternoon, the men gathered outside the men's house, the larger of the 2 rectangular buildings in the center. They worked on their hair for a while, cutting and cleaning, then began to wrestle. The matchups were one-on-one and toe-to-toe, with the object being to throw the opponent to the ground. It was a rough game, but with strict rules and smiles afterward. The chief settled any disputes. The women watched from their doorways with only a passing interest, as if they were expected to. Little boys imitated their fathers. And Nate sat on a block of wood under a tree, watching a drama from another age, and wondering, not for the first time, where he was. Chapter 29 Few of the Indians around Nate knew the girl's name was Ayesh. She was only a child, and she lived in another village. They all knew, though, that a girl had been bitten. They gossiped about it throughout the day, while they kept their own children closer at hand. Word came during dinner that the girl had died. A messenger arrived in a rush and delivered the news to the chief, and it swept through the huts in a matter of minutes. Mothers gathered their little ones even closer. Dinner resumed until there was movement along the main trail. Rachel was returning with Laco and the other men who'd been with her all day. As she entered the village, the eating and the chatting stopped, as everyone stood and stared. They lowered their heads as she walked by their huts. She smiled at some, whispered to others, paused long enough to say something to the chief, then continued to her hut, followed by Laco, whose limp was worse. She passed near the tree where Nate and Jevy and their Indian had spent most of the afternoon, but she didn't see them. She wasn't looking. She was tired and suffering and seemed anxious to get home. "What do we do now?" Nate asked Jevy, who passed the question along in Portuguese. "We wait," came the reply. Surprise, surprise. Laco found them as the sun was falling behind the mountains. Jevy and the Indian went to eat leftovers. Nate followed the boy along the trail to Rachel's dwelling. She was standing in the door, drying her face with a hand towel. Her hair was wet, and she had changed clothes. "Good evening, Mr. O'Reilly," she said, in the same low, slow tone that betrayed nothing. "Hello, Rachel. Please call me Nate." "Sit over there, Nate," she said, pointing to a short, square stump, remarkably similar to the one he'd been perched upon for the past 6 hours. It was in front of the hut, near a ring of rocks where she made her fires. He sat, his rear still numb. "I'm sorry about the little girl," Nate said.
"She is with the Lord."
"Her poor parents aren't."
"No, they are grieving. It's very sad."
She sat in the doorway, arms folded over her knees, eyes lost in the distance. The boy stood guard under a nearby tree, almost unseen in the darkness.
"I would invite you into my home," she said, "but it would not be proper.
No problem here.
Only married people can be alone indoors at this time of the day. It's a custom.
When in Rome, do like the Romans.
Rome is very far away.
Everything is very far away.
Yes, it is. Are you hungry?
Are you?
No. But then I don't eat much.
I'm fine. We need to talk.
I'm sorry about today. I'm sure you understand.
Of course.
I have some manioc and some juice, if you'd like.
No, really, I'm okay.
What did you do today?
Oh, we met with the chief, had breakfast at his table, hiked back to the first village, got the boat, worked on it, set up our tent behind the chief's hut, then waited for you.
The chief liked you?
Evidently, he wants us to stay.
What do you think of my people?
They're all naked.
They always have been.
How long did it take to get accustomed to it?
I don't know, a couple of years. It gradually grows on you, like everything else. I was homesick for 3 years, and there are times now when I would like to drive a car, eat a pizza, and see a good movie. But you adjust.
I can't begin to imagine.
It's a matter of calling. I became a Christian when I was 14 years old, and I knew then that God wanted me to be a missionary. I didn't know exactly where, but I put my faith in him.
He picked a hell of a spot.
I enjoy your English, but please don't swear.
Sorry. Can we talk about Troy? The shadows were falling fast. They were 10 feet apart and could still see each other, but the blackness would soon separate them.
Suit yourself, she said with a weary air of resignation.
Troy had 3 wives and 6 children. 6 that we knew about. You, of course, were a surprise. He didn't like the other 6, but evidently was quite fond of you. He left them virtually nothing, just enough to cover their debts. Everything else was given to Rachel Lane, born out of wedlock on November 2, 1954, at Catholic Hospital in New Orleans, to a woman named Evelyn Cunningham, now deceased. That Rachel would be you. The words fell heavy in the thick air. There were no other sounds. Her silhouette absorbed them, and, as usual, she thought before she spoke.
Troy wasn't fond of me. We hadn't seen each other in 20 years.
That's not important. He left his fortune to you. No one had a chance to ask why, because he jumped out of a window after signing his last testament. I have a copy for you.
I don't want to see it.
And I have some other papers which I'd like you to sign, maybe tomorrow, first thing, when we can see. Then I can be on my way.
What kind of papers?
Legal stuff, all for your benefit.
You're not concerned about my benefit.
Her words were much quicker and sharper, and Nate was stung by the rebuke. That's not true, he replied weakly.
Sure it is. You don't know what I want, or need, or like, or dislike. You don't know me, Nate, so how can you know what will or will not benefit me?
Okay, you're right. I don't know you. You don't know me. I'm here on behalf of your father's estate. It is still very hard for me to believe that I am actually sitting in the dark outside a hut in a primitive Indian village lost in a swamp the size of Colorado, in a third world country I've never seen before, talking to a very lovely missionary who just happens to be the richest woman in the world. Yes, you're right, I don't know what benefits you. But it is very important for you to see these papers and to sign them.
I'm not signing anything.
Oh, come on.
I have no interest in your papers.
You haven't seen them yet.
Tell me about them.
They're formalities. My firm has to probate your father's estate. All of the heirs named in his will must inform the court, either in person or in writing, that they have been notified of the proceedings and have been given the opportunity to take part. It's required by the law.
And if I refuse?
Honestly, I haven't thought about that. It's so routine that everybody simply cooperates.
So I submit myself to the court in Virginia. The probate court there takes jurisdiction over you even though you're absent.
I'm not sure if I like that idea.
Fine, then hop in the boat and we'll go to Washington.
I'm not leaving.
And with that, a long silence ensued, a pause made even quieter by the darkness that now engulfed them. The boy was perfectly still under the tree. The Indians were settling in their huts, with no noise except for the cry of an infant.
"I'll get us some juice," she almost whispered,
then moved into the house. Nate stood and stretched his tender body and slapped at mosquitoes. His repellent was in his tent. There was a small light of some sort flickering through the house. Rachel held a clay pot with a flame in the center.
"These are leaves from that tree over there," she explained as she sat it on the ground by the door. "We burned them to keep mosquitoes away. Sit here, close to it."
Nate did as he was told. She returned with two cups filled with a liquid he could not see.
"It's macajuno, similar to orange juice."
They sat together on the ground, almost touching, with their backs resting against the hut, the burning pot not far from their feet.
"Speak softly," she said. "Voices carry in the dark, and the Indians are trying to sleep. They are also very curious about us."
"They can't understand anything."
"Yes, but they will listen anyway."
Soap had not touched his body in days, and he was suddenly concerned with his hygiene. He took a small sip, then another.
"Do you have a family?" she asked.
"I've had a couple. 2 marriages, 2 divorces, 4 children. I now live alone."
"Divorce is so easy, isn't it?"
Nate took a very small sip of the warm liquid. He had thus far managed to avoid the raging diarrhea that struck so many foreigners. Surely the murky liquid was harmless. 2 Americans alone in the wilderness. With so much to talk about, why couldn't they avoid divorce? Actually, they were quite painful.
"But we move on. We marry, then divorce. Find someone else, marry, then divorce. Find someone else."
"We?"
"I'm just using the pronoun. Civilized people. Educated, complicated people. The Indians never divorce."
"They haven't seen my first wife, either."
"She was unpleasant?"
Nate exhaled and took another drink. "Indulge her," he told himself. "She's desperate for conversation with one of her own."
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm not prying. It's not important."
She was not a bad person. Not in the early years. I worked hard, drank even harder. When I wasn't at the office, I was in a bar. She became resentful, then mean, then vicious. Things spiraled out of control, and we grew to hate each other. The little confessional was over in a flash, and it was enough for both of them. His marital debris seemed so irrelevant then and there.
"You've never married?"
he asked.
"No."
She took a sip. She was left-handed, and when she raised the cup, her elbow touched Nate's.
"Paul never married, you know."
"Paul who?"
"The Apostle Paul."
"Oh, that Paul."
"Do you read the Bible?"
"No."
"I thought I was in love once, in college. I wanted to marry him, but the Lord led me away."
"Why?"
"Because the Lord wanted me here. The boy I loved was a good Christian, but he was weak physically. He would have never survived on the mission field."
"How long will you stay here?"
"I don't plan to leave."
"So the Indians will bury you?"
"I suppose. It's not something I worry about."
"Do most World Tribes missionaries die in the field?"
"No. Most retire and go home. But then they have families to bury them."
"You'd have lots of family and friends if you went home now. You'd be quite famous."
"That's another good reason to stay here. This is home.
I don't want the money.
Don't be foolish.
I'm not foolish. Money means nothing to me. That should be obvious.
You don't even know how much it is.
I haven't asked. I went about my work today with no thought of the money. I'll do the same tomorrow and the next day.
It's 11 billion, give or take.
Is that supposed to impress me?
It got my attention.
But you worship money, Nate. You're part of a culture where everything is measured by money. It's a religion.
True. But sex is pretty important, too.
Okay, money and sex. What else?
Fame. Everybody wants to be a celebrity.
It's a sad culture. People live in a frenzy. They work all the time to make money, to buy things, to impress other people. They're measured by what they own.
Am I included?
Are you?
I suppose.
Then you're living without God. You're a very lonely person, Nate. I can sense it. You don't know God.
He squirmed and considered a quick defense, but the truth disarmed him. He had no weapons, no punches, no foundation to stand on.
I believe in God, he said, truthfully but weakly. It's easy to say that, she said, her words still slow and soft. And I don't doubt you. But saying is one thing. Living is another matter. That crippled boy under the tree over there is Laco. He's 17, small for his age, and always sick. His mother told me he was born early. Laco is the first to catch every disease that comes our way. I doubt if he'll live to be 30. Laco doesn't care. Laco became a Christian several years ago, and he has the sweetest spirit of anyone here. He talks to God all day long. In fact, he's probably praying right now. He has no worries, no fears. If he has a problem, he goes straight to God and leaves it there.
Nate looked at the darkness under the tree where Laco was praying, but saw nothing.
She continued, "That little Indian has nothing on this earth, but he's storing riches in heaven. He knows that when he dies, he'll spend eternity in heaven with his Creator. Laco is a wealthy boy."
"What about Troy?"
"I doubt if Troy believed in Christ when he died. If not, then he's burning in hell right now."
"You don't believe that?"
"Hell is a very real place, Nate. Read the Bible. Right now, Troy would give his 11 billion for a drink of cold water."
Nate was ill-equipped to argue theology with a missionary, and he knew it. He said nothing for a while, and she took the cue. Minutes passed as the last infant fell asleep in the village. The night was perfectly black and still. No moon or stars, the only light coming from the thin yellow flame near their feet. Very gently she touched him. She patted him 3 times on his arm and said,
"I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that you are lonely. How would I know?"
"It's okay."
She kept her fingers on his arm, as if desperate to touch something. "You are a good person, aren't you, Nate?"
"No. I am actually not a good person. I do lots of bad things. I am weak and fragile, and I don't want to talk about it. I didn't come here to find God. Finding you was hard enough. I'm required by law to give you these papers."
"I'm not signing the papers, and I don't want the money."
"Come on.
Please don't beg. My decision is final. Let's not talk about the money."
"But the money is the only reason I'm here."
She removed her fingers, but managed to lean an inch or two closer so that their knees were touching. "I'm sorry you came. You've wasted a trip."
Another gap in the conversation. He needed to relieve himself.
but the thought of stepping 3 feet in any direction was horrifying. Laco said something and startled Nate. He was less than 10 feet away, still unseen.
"He needs to go to his hut," she said, rising to her feet. "Follow him."
Nate unfolded himself and slowly stood, joints popping and muscles reluctantly stretching.
"I would like to leave tomorrow."
"Good. I'll speak to the chief."
"It won't be a problem, will it?"
"Probably not."
"I need 30 minutes of your time to at least go over the papers and show you a copy of the will."
"We can talk. Good night."
He practically breathed down the back of Laco's neck as they shuffled along the short trail and into the village.
"Over here," Chevy whispered in the dark.
He had somehow managed to secure the use of 2 hammocks on the small porch of the men's building. Nate asked how. Chevy promised to explain in the morning. Laco vanished in the night. Chapter 30 F. Parr Wycliffe was in his courtroom, running late with a docket of dull motion hearings. Josh waited in the judge's office with the video. He paced the floor of the cluttered room, gripping his cell phone, his mind in another hemisphere. There was still no word from Nate. Valdir's assurances seemed well rehearsed. The Pantanal is a big place. The guide is very good. The boat is large. The Indians move about. The Indians do not wish to be found. Everything is fine. He would call when he heard from Nate. Josh had considered the idea of a rescue, but getting to Corumbá seemed enough of a challenge. Penetrating the Pantanal to find a missing lawyer seemed impossible. Still, he could go there and sit with Valdir until they heard something. He was working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, and the Phelan matter was about to explode. Josh barely had time for lunch, let alone a trip to Brazil. He tried Valdir on his cell phone, but the line was busy. Wycliffe entered the office, apologizing and removing his robe at the same time. He wanted to impress a powerful lawyer like Stafford with the importance of his docket. It was just the two of them. They watched the first part of the video without comment. It began with old Troy sitting in his wheelchair, Josh adjusting the microphone in front of him, and the 3 psychiatrists with their pages of questions. The exam lasted 21 minutes and ended with the unanimous opinions that Mr. Phelan knew exactly what he was doing. Wycliffe couldn't suppress a grin. The room cleared. The camera directly across from Troy was kept on. He whipped out the holographic will and signed it 4 minutes after the mental exam had ended.
"This is where he jumps," Josh said.
The camera didn't move. It caught Troy as he suddenly pushed back from the table and stood. He disappeared off-screen as Josh and Sneed and Tip Durbin watched in disbelief for a second, then bolted after the old man. The footage was quite dramatic. 5.5 minutes elapse. The camera records nothing but empty chairs and voices. Then poor Sneed takes the seat where Troy sat. He's visibly shaken and on the verge of tears, but manages to tell the camera what he just witnessed. Josh and Tip Durbin do the same thing. 39 minutes of video. "How are they going to unravel that?" Wycliffe asked when it was over. It was a question with no answer. 2 of the heirs, Rex and Libigail, had already filed petitions to contest the will. Their lawyers, Hart Geddes and Wally Bright, respectively, had managed to attract significant attention and get themselves interviewed and photographed by the press. The other heirs would quickly follow suit. Josh had spoken with most of their lawyers, and the scramble for the courthouse was in process. "Every discredited shrink in the country wants a piece of this," Josh said. "There will be lots of opinions."
"Does the suicide worry you?"
"Sure it does. But he planned everything so carefully, even his death. He knew precisely how and when he wanted to die."
"What about the other will, the thick one he signed first?"
"He didn't sign it."
"But I saw him. It's on the video."
"No,
he scrawled the name Mickey Mouse.
Wycliffe was taking notes on a legal pad, and his hand stopped in mid-sentence.
Mickey Mouse? He repeated.
Here's where we are, Judge. From 1982 until 1996, I prepared 11 wills for Mr. Phelan. Some were thick, others were thin, and they disposed of his fortune in more ways than you can imagine. The law says that with each new will, the old one has to be destroyed. So I would bring the new will to his office, we'd spend 2 hours nitpicking our way through it, then he'd sign it. I kept the wills in my office, and I always brought the last one along. Once he signed the new one, we, Mr. Phelan and I, would feed the old one through a shredder he kept near his desk. It was a ceremony that he enjoyed immensely. He'd be happy for a few months, then one of his kids would make him mad, and he'd start talking about changing his will. If the heirs can prove that he lacked sufficient mental capacity when he executed the handwritten will, then there is no other will. They were all destroyed.
In which case he died without a will, Wycliffe added.
Yes. And as you well know, under Virginia law, his estate is then divided among his children.
7 children. $11 billion.
7 that we know about. 11 billion seems to be fairly accurate. Wouldn't you attack the will?
A big, nasty will contest was exactly what Wycliffe wanted, and he knew that the lawyers, including Josh Stafford, would get even richer from the war. But the battle needed 2 sides, and so far only 1 had surfaced. Someone had to defend Mr. Phelan's last testament.
"Any word from Rachel Lane?" he asked.
"No, but we're looking."
"Where is she?"
"We think she's a missionary somewhere in South America, but we haven't found her. We have people down there."
Josh realized he was using the word people quite loosely.
Wycliffe was gazing at the ceiling, deep in thought.
Why would he give $11 billion to an illegitimate daughter who is a missionary?
"I can't answer that, Judge. He surprised me so many times that I became jaded."
"Sounds a little crazy, doesn't it?"
"It's strange."
"Did you know about her?"
"No."
"Could there be other heirs?"
"Anything is possible."
"Do you think he was unbalanced?"
"No." "Weird, eccentric, whimsical, mean as hell. But he knew what he was doing."
"Find the girl, Josh."
"We're trying."
The meeting involved only the chief and Rachel. From where Nate sat, on the porch under his hammock, he could see their faces and hear their voices. The chief was bothered by something in the clouds. He would talk, then listen to Rachel, then raise his eyes slowly upward, as if anticipating death from the skies. It was obvious to Nate that the chief not only listened to Rachel, but also sought her advice. Around them, the morning meal was winding down as the Ipecac prepared for another day. The hunters gathered in small groups at the men's house to sharpen their arrows and string their bows. The fishermen laid out their nets and lines. The young women began the day-long task of keeping the dirt properly swept around their huts. Their mothers were leaving for the gardens and fields near the forest.
"He thinks it's going to storm," Rachel explained when the meeting was over. "He says you can go, but he will not send a guide. It's too dangerous."
"Can we make it without a guide?" Nate asked.
"Yes," Chevy said,
and Nate shot him a look that conveyed many thoughts.
"It would not be wise," she said. "The rivers run together. It's easy to get lost. Even the Ipecacs have lost fishermen during the rainy season."
"When might the storm be over?" Nate asked.
"We'll have to wait and see."
Nate breathed deeply as his shoulders sagged. He was sore and tired, covered with mosquito bites, hungry, sick of his little adventure, and worried that Josh was worried. His mission so far had been a failure. He wasn't homesick because there was nothing at home, but he wanted to see Corumbá again, with its cozy little cafes and nice hotels and lazy streets. He wanted another opportunity to be alone, clean and sober, and drinking himself to death.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I really need to get back. There are people at the office waiting to hear from me. This has already taken much longer than expected." She listened, but she really didn't care. A few worried people in a law office in D.C. didn't concern her that much. "Can we talk?" he asked.
"I have to go to the next village for the funeral of the little girl. Why don't you go with me? We will have plenty of time to talk."
Lako led the way, his right foot twisted in so that with each step he dipped to the left, then jerked himself to the right. It was painful to watch. Rachel followed him, then Nate, laden with a cloth bag she brought. Javi stayed well behind them, afraid he might overhear their conversation. Beyond the oval ring of huts, they passed small square patches of farmland, now abandoned and overrun with scrub brush.
"The Ipikas grow their food on small plots which they carve out of the jungle," she explained.
Nate was close behind her, trying to keep up. She took long strides with her wiry legs. A 2-mile hike through the woods was child's play.
"They are hard on the soil, and after a few years it stops producing. They abandon it, nature reclaims it, and they dig farther into the jungle. In the long run, the soil returns to normal and no harm is done. Land means everything to the Indians. It is their life. Most of it has been taken away by the civilized folks."
"Sounds familiar."
"Yes, it does. We decimate their population with bloodshed and disease, and take away their land. Then we put them on reservations and can't understand why they're not happy about it."
She said hello to 2 naked little ladies tilling soil near the trail.
"The women get the hard work," Nate observed.
"Yes, but the work is easy compared to childbirth."
"I'd rather watch them work."
The air was humid but free of the smoke that hung eternally over the village. When they entered the woods, Nate was already sweating.
"So tell me about yourself, Nate," she said over her shoulder. "Where were you born?"
"This could take a while."
"Just hit the high points."
"There are more low ones."
"Come on, Nate. You wanted to talk? Let's talk. The hike takes half an hour."
"I was born in Baltimore, oldest of 2 sons. Parents divorced when I was 15, high school at St. Paul, college at Hopkins, law school at Georgetown, then I never left D.C.
"Was it a happy childhood?"
"I suppose. Lots of sports. My father worked for National Brewery for 30 years, and he always had tickets to the Colts and Orioles. Baltimore is a great city."
"Are we going to talk about your childhood?"
"If you like. It wasn't very happy."
What a surprise, thought Nate. This poor woman has never had a chance at happiness.
"Did you want to be a lawyer when you grew up?"
"Of course not. No kid in his right mind wants to be a lawyer. I was going to play for the Colts, or the Orioles, maybe both."
"Did you go to church?"
"Sure. Every Christmas and Easter."
The trail almost disappeared, and they were wading through stiff weeds. Nate walked while watching her boots, and when he couldn't see them, he said, "This snake that killed the girl, what kind is it?"
"It's called a bima, but don't worry."
"Why shouldn't I worry?"
"Because you're wearing boots. It's a small snake that bites below the ankle."
"The big one will find me."
"Relax."
"What about Lako up there? He's never worn shoes."
"Yes, but he sees everything."
"I take it the bima is quite deadly."
"It can be, but there is an antivenin. I've actually had it here before, and if I'd had it yesterday, the little girl wouldn't have died."
"Then, if you had lots of money, you could buy lots of antivenin. You could stock your shelves with all the medicines you need. You could buy a nice little outboard to take you to Corumbá and back. You could build a clinic and a church and a school and spread the gospel all over the Pantanal."
She stopped and turned abruptly. They were face to face.
"I've done nothing to earn the money, and I didn't know the man who made it. Please don't mention it again."
Her words were firm, but her face gave no hint of frustration.
"Give it away. Give it all to charity."
"It's not mine to give."
"It'll be squandered.
Millions will go to the lawyers, and what's left will be divided among your siblings. And believe me, you don't want that. You have no idea of the misery and heartache these people will cause if they get the money. What they don't waste, they'll pass down to their kids, and the Phelan money will pollute the next generation. She took his wrist and squeezed it. Very slowly she said, "I don't care. I'll pray for them." Then she turned and started walking again. Laco was far ahead. Jevy could barely be seen behind them. They hiked in silence through a field near a stream, then entered a patch of tall, thick trees. The limbs and branches were woven together to form a dark canopy. The air was suddenly cool.
"Let's take a break," she said.
The stream curved through the woods, and the trail crossed it in a bed of blue and orange rocks. She knelt by the water and splashed her face.
"You can drink this," she said. "It comes from the mountains."
Nate squatted near her and felt the water. It was cold and clear.
"This is my favorite spot," she said. "I come here almost every day to bathe, to pray, to meditate."
"It's hard to believe we're in the Ponta now. It's much too cool."
"We're on the very edge of it. The mountains of Bolivia are not far away. The Ponta now begins somewhere near here and stretches east forever."
"I know. We flew over it trying to find you."
"Oh, you did?"
"Yes. It was a short flight, but I had a good view of the Ponta now."
"And you didn't find me?"
"No. We flew into a storm and had to make an emergency landing. I got lucky and walked away. I'll never get near another small airplane."
"There's no place to land around here."
They took off their socks and boots and dipped their feet into the stream. They sat on the rocks and listened as the water trickled by. They were alone. Neither Laco nor Jevy were within eyesight.
"When I was a little girl in Montana, we lived in a small town where my father, my adoptive father, was a minister. Not far from the edge of town was a little creek, about the size of this. And there was a place, under some tall trees, similar to these, where I would go and put my feet in the water and sit for hours."
"Were you hiding?"
"Sometimes."
"Are you hiding now?"
"No."
"I think you are."
"No, you are wrong. I have perfect peace, Nate. I surrendered my will to Christ many years ago, and I follow wherever he leads. You think I'm lonely. You're wrong. He is with me every step of the way. He knows my thoughts, my needs, and he takes away my fears and worries. I am completely and perfectly at peace in this world."
"I've never heard that before."
"You said last night that you are weak and fragile. What does that mean?"
"Confession was good for the soul," Sergio had told him during therapy. If she wanted to know, then he would try and shock her with the truth. "I'm an alcoholic," he said, almost proudly, the way he'd been trained to admit it during rehab. "I've hit the bottom 4 times in the past 10 years. And I came out of detox to make this trip. I cannot say for sure that I will never drink again. I've kicked cocaine 3 times, and I think, though I'm not certain, that I will never touch the stuff again. I filed for bankruptcy 4 months ago, while in rehab. I'm currently under indictment for income tax evasion and stand a 50-50 chance of going to jail and losing my license to practice law. You know about the 2 divorces. Both women dislike me, and they've poisoned my children. I've done a fine job of wrecking my life." There was no noticeable pleasure or relief in laying himself bare. She took it without flinching.
"Anything else?" she asked.
"Oh, yes. I've tried to kill myself at least twice, that I can recall. Once last August that landed me in rehab, then just a few days ago in Corumbá. I think it was Christmas night."
"In Corumbá?"
"Yes, in my hotel room. I almost drank myself to death with cheap vodka.
You poor man.
I'm sick, okay? I have a disease. I've admitted it many times, to many counselors.
Have you ever confessed it to God?
I'm sure he knows.
I'm sure he does. But he won't help unless you ask. He is omnipotent, but you have to go to him in prayer, in the spirit of forgiveness.
What happens?
Your sins will be forgiven. Your slate will be wiped clean. Your addictions will be taken away. The Lord will forgive all of your transgressions, and you will become a new believer in Christ.
What about the IRS?
That won't go away, but you'll have the strength to deal with it. Through prayer, you can overcome any adversity.
Nate had been preached at before. He had surrendered to higher powers so many times he could almost deliver the sermons. He had been counseled by ministers and therapists and gurus and shrinks of every stripe and variety. Once, during a 3-year stretch of sobriety, he actually worked as a counselor for AA, teaching the 12-point recovery plan to other alcoholics in the basement of an old church in Alexandria. Then, he crashed. Why shouldn't she try to save him? Wasn't it her calling in life to convert the lost?
I don't know how to pray, he said. She took his hand and squeezed it firmly. Close your eyes, Nate. Repeat after me. Dear God, forgive me of my sins and help me to forgive those who have sinned against me.
Nate mumbled the words and squeezed her hand even harder. It sounded vaguely similar to the Lord's Prayer.
Give me strength to overcome temptations and addictions and the trials ahead.
Nate kept mumbling, kept repeating her words, but the little ritual was confusing. Prayer was easy for Rachel because she did so much of it. For him, it was a strange rite.
Amen, she said.
They opened their eyes, but kept their hands together. They listened to the water as it rushed gently over the rocks. There was an odd sensation as his burdens seemed to be lifted.